In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Stephen Batchelor. He has written quite a bit on Buddhism. He is a former monk in the Tibetan and Zen traditions. He's the author of a number of books, including a national bestseller titled Buddhism Without Beliefs. And he lectures and conducts meditation retreats around the world. He's a contributor to Tricycle, the Buddhist magazine. And he's the author of a new book that is a consideration of issues of good and evil, definitely mostly from a Buddhist perspective. And the title of the book is Living with the Devil, and it's published by Riverhead Books. And we'll be talking about it this morning in this part of the show. As we do that, of course, questions are welcome. People who are listening are certainly welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, for folks who would like to be involved in the conversation, the number to call is 333-9455. We also do, though, have that toll-free line, and that means if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel, or in fact, if you would happen to be listening on the internet, you can use the toll-free line as long as you're in the United States, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Stephen Batchelor, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Well, and I appreciate your giving us some of your time this morning.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
The book is mostly about Buddhism and about thinking about good and evil from a Buddhist perspective, but it does consider how other faith traditions, particularly those in the Judeo-Christian Islamic kind of line, think about the same thing, and also how these different traditions and Buddhism as well talk about the devil. And maybe to start, we might just talk for a moment about Christianity and take people to the story, and I'm sure that Christians will know the story of the temptation of Christ.
Yes.
That is told in the New Testament, where Satan appears actually embodied in the form of a guy. He appears to Jesus, and there is this series of three, good number that three, the series of these three proposals that he makes that Satan tries to tempt Jesus, and finally he is not successful, and Jesus tells him to get lost.
Right.
But what's interesting here is that and if you look at Satan in the New Testament, Satan in the Old Testament, we see that in the New Testament here it's not an abstract concept. It's an embodied individual. It's actually he becomes a person.
Yeah.
It's interesting what happens when you look throughout the scripture, the Christian scriptures, the New Testament and the Old Testament, how this notion of the embodiment of evil changes. So let's just start with the story that people will kind of know about Jesus and Satan.
In the temptation.
Just give us the thumbnail sketch.
Well, I'm not a Christian theologian, so I apologize if I get any of my stuff wrong. But the crisis that Jesus faces in the desert, in the wilderness, these temptations with Satan, is really a way of talking about how even someone who has a great sense of mission, maybe even a deep revelation of his or her role on earth, divinely inspired in this particular case, is nonetheless still subject to the, I would probably consider them kind of biological, neurological habits and patterns, whereby the person is tempted to somehow compromise their vision, compromise their mission by taking all the credit for them themselves. And although Satan appears to Christ as an embodied personality, I think probably for most people reading that text today, they will not take that entirely literally, but they will see this as a figurative way of talking about a struggle that Christ is certainly going through in this wilderness, in this space where there's nobody else to give him any support. He's alone. He's confronting his darkest demons, as we would say at this point. And although these very powerful urges and images arise in his mind, which is portrayed in the story, obviously, by this personified other, Satan, but I would understand this as Christ being able to face those last vestiges of his ego-driven life, his self-centered life, his desire for wealth, his desire for power. And on each occasion, he's able to confront those forces, in this case, confront Satan, and not be swayed by these extraordinarily seductive offers that are being placed before him. And it's in that moment, I feel, that Jesus, as it were, has overcome those forces that heretofore had somehow not necessarily dictated, but had influenced the course of his life. And he makes, therefore, a radical break at this point with that past, and from that point on, once he returns from the wilderness, he is able to embark on his teaching, on his mission, or however he would have seen that, with the confidence that he's now, as it were, freed from those kinds of impulses, those kinds of thoughts. They've lost their power over him at that point.
Mm. So that's interesting. You gave the qualification that you were not a Christian theologian, but you're pointing at this as an important event. A turning point in the life of this character,
yeah,
of Jesus, and
yeah,
that, that it has to do with, because what, if people remember the story, what, and I guess there are different versions depending on who's telling the story, but essentially he's in the wilderness to fast, to meditate. It's a spiritual exercise,
yeah,
and Satan comes along and says, "Well, if you're hungry, there's a stone there. Well, just take that stone and make it into bread." And there's also he takes him to a high point and says, "Well, you know, God loves you. There's no problem here. Go ahead, jump off, and he'll send angels to rescue you." And then finally, the last thing Satan says, "Well, if you look here," he's again in a high point, and he shows him the whole world, and he says, "I will, if you bow down and worship me, I'll give you all. Give you all this." And in every case, Jesus says no. He turns him down. So, and it does seem to be in a sense, it's a rejection of the demands of it's a rejection of the demands of the physical body, a rejection of the demands of the physical world. It's in a sense sort of saying that these things which you were offering me, these things that you are trying to tempt me with, are not real. In the sense that they're not what matters most.
Exactly, yes.
And it's interesting that you tell the story here in the book that if you look at the Buddhist tradition, there is a very similar kind of story about Buddha, and again at the point where he's trying to, you know, he's engaged in spiritual exercise, he's wrestling with these sort of issues about what really matters and about dealing with all the burdens that being a physical human being come with, and so a figure that is very much the same kind of figure embodied physical way appears to Buddha and engages in the same kind of exercise. So there's, in a sense, Satan, if you want to use that word, in the Buddhist tradition there's a different name, but essentially there's the same sort of temptation story with Buddha.
That's absolutely right, and I find that extraordinarily interesting. The Buddhist story, of course, predates the gospel narrative Buddha lived about 500 years before Christ. These episodes were not probably written down until about 200 BC, but nonetheless, we sense in reading both, at least I do, that we're talking very much about the same kind of thing here. And just as Christ undergoes these temptations, faces down Satan, and then proceeds on his life's work, the same thing more or less happens to Buddha, who again has been, in his case, for about 5 or 6 years, living in the forests, practicing austerities, meditations, and so on. And he reaches also a kind of critical point. He somehow gets to an impasse, and so he sits beneath a tree, the famous Bodhi tree, and vows that he will not get up from beneath that tree until he has resolved these primary questions of his life, what really matters, as you put it. And it's towards the end of that seven-day period under this tree that he, too, is confronted by the forces of Mara. Mara is the word Buddhists use for the devil. And he, too, is, albeit in a much more Indian, rather grandiose kind of language, is likewise confronted with the deepest forces in his own body, sexuality in particular, the temptations of wealth, of power, and so forth and so on. And likewise, he does not give in to these things. And not only is it a not giving in to them, but the question surely is, well, how does he not give in to them? The Buddhist answer to that would be through being able to face them and to understand them for what they are, as impersonal drives and forces and so on, and not to fall into the trap of thinking that that's, in a sense, who he really is, that these are powers, they are very defining powers for most of our lives, and yet we do not have to go along with them. There is a possibility of being fully in the world in that way, in the body, conscious of what's going on around one, and yet at the same time in seeing that to be somehow freed from the dictates of such ideas and such feeling. And so Buddha likewise overcomes the forces of Mara by not going along with them, and it's at that moment that the Buddhist tradition regards the Buddha as achieving his enlightenment or his awakening, in which he suddenly has a deep insight into the nature of what truly matters in a human life. And from that moment, and then in his case for the next 50 years, he lives until the age of 80, he proceeds to explain and to teach and to communicate and to create communities that are founded on these insights that he has gained.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour for anyone who might have tuned in, Stephen Batchelor. He's a former monk in both the Tibetan and Zen Buddhist traditions. He's the author of a number of books about Buddhism, including a bestseller titled Buddhism Without Beliefs. He lectures and conducts meditation retreats around the world. He is author of a book that explores this idea that we're talking about here this morning. It is titled Living with the Devil, A Meditation on Good and Evil, and it's published by Riverhead Books. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to go back to this idea that I touched on about how within the Jewish and Christian traditions, if you look at Satan, and look at the Old Testament, look at the New Testament, there's an interesting thing that happens with Satan in the New Testament becoming more of this embodied thing, this person virtually, that is the enemy of God, where his stated purpose is to do everything that he can to bring down the creation and bring down human beings. It's a personal thing,
yes,
between him and God. Interesting, when you look back at the Old Testament and you look at what in the Old Testament is called the Satan, Satan, uh-huh, is that it's very different. And it's interesting if you look at what that word means, because it means something like, you know, something like obstacle, something like impediment, something like, you know, it's something that's thrown in your way. And that the role that Satan performs is more as an agent of God in a challenging kind of mode.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at that, then, and if you sort of strip away this idea that Satan is actually a guy,
mm-hmm,
and that he has a grudge against God and he's just out to get God and humanity, then it takes us to a different level where you think about the spiritual kind of quest that both Buddha and Jesus were involved in, and that what maybe the point of that story, of those stories, are, is not so much that there was this embodied essence of evil that was there challenging them, but that in a sense they were challenging themselves, and what they were looking at was obstacles on their way down the path of spiritual fulfillment. And that's a little bit, that's one way of looking at what both of those stories are about.
Yes, no, absolutely. The power, though, of the figurative language, in other words, Satan in Judaism or Christianity or Islam, Mara in Buddhism, is that by taking an embodied form of a personality, the complexity and the tricksterish quality of the obstacle becomes that much more vivid. The danger with theology or philosophy or psychology nowadays is that we take that figurative image and we dismiss it as it's an old-fashioned way of talking, it's a fairy tale, it's a myth or whatever. But what it really means, we say to ourselves, is some kind of psychological force within ourselves or whatever. Now, that is very helpful, and I think it sheds an enormous amount of light in deconstructing a myth, in other words, a story with apparent personalities discussing things with one another. But the problem also is that once you reduce Satan or Mara to psychological forces, let's say, you also, I think, miss something. I think you miss the power of that mythic language. And that sort of language speaks to us, as, for example, we still read the great myths of the Greek gods and so on. It speaks to us in a way that can't quite be captured just by reducing everything to psychological or philosophical terms. And I find these passages, be it in the Old and the New Testaments, in Buddhism, they speak to me at so many different levels. They seem to engage the whole of my person. They make me realize that the obstacles I face are not just negative thoughts I might have in my mind, or a moment of lust, or a moment of hatred, but actually somehow the very structure of this physical organism, the very structure of the world itself, so often appears to get in the way of our being able to realize our deepest values, what we long for really in the heart of ourselves to bring into being in this short life we have on earth. So for example, a political tyranny, for example, could stand in my way. If I wish to practice as a Christian, say, in a country like North Korea, for example, or even in Iran, I would not be allowed to do that. There would be forces, social and ecclesiastical, political forces ranged against me such that I would not be free to do that. It could also be that I suffer an accident and that causes me some grievous injury that likewise handicaps me, debilitates me in a certain way. Or it may be because of the responsibilities I have in my life for my family or for my colleagues. Any number of things can obstruct us, can block us. And of course, I think in our psychologically literate times, we're aware more and more, thanks to Freud and Jung and others, of how we also have these inner demons, that we have attachments, we have fears, we have insecurities, which likewise inhibit us from taking those risks to write the novel we've always wanted to write, or to say what we really feel about someone we love. So often we find ourselves hemmed in there too. And the figure of Satan, the figure of Mara, somehow captures the range of the obstructable nature of our existence and addresses that in a very complex, quixotic way, which is so much, I feel, the flavor we find sometimes when we feel hemmed in, we feel trapped, we feel stuck in our in the unfolding of our lives.
Hmm. Well, just when after I had finished looking at Living with the Devil, I guess the idea that I came away with, which you were suggesting, was that the obstructions are within ourselves. I mean, we are our own devil.
Yes, exactly.
And not that you were saying that somehow there is, that it's something that exists embodied outside of ourselves.
No, that is absolutely right. Okay. Yes, of course.
Well, let's talk with a caller here. We have someone who's been listening here in Champaign, and we'll bring them in. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I have a couple of peripheral questions. Maybe you can answer at the end, and then I have a major question. But are you really a former monk, or you're just not living in a monastery? And then about Tibetan and Zen Buddhism, do you find those complementary or contradictory, or that they both get you to the same place? But before you answer that, I wanted to talk about good and evil. And it seems to be a major theme these days, brought out, you know, by political leaders, and maybe it's something that comes to everyone's mind considering some of the things that are going on in the world. And some people seem to want to frame these things in some kind of civilizational battle, and on both sides there are people that, you know, seem to think they have a corner on the good or on God, and yet some very evil practices seem to be being engaged in. And so I'm just wondering, I mean, both the Muslim world and the Western world are influenced by, you know, ancient biblical Hebrew ideas and Greek ideas and maybe Zoroastrian ideas. And I guess the individual person wants to do good. Maybe I'm wrong. A lot of people want to do good or be good. Maybe there are not, you know, maybe it's not innately human to want to be good, but it seems it's very common. But, you know, people seem to sometimes desire to be good but end up doing more harm in trying too hard, or that they seem to be attached to some certainty of their method or to some discourse that kind of actually acts as an illusion. Maybe you can talk about
that. Well, let me just run through those questions in that order. The earlier ones I can deal with quite easily. I am a former monk. I was ordained for 10 years in both Tibetan and Zen traditions. I disrobe now nearly 20 years ago, so that's quite some way back. And my life since then has been devoted very much to trying to understand Buddhist teaching, trying to communicate its ideas in a way that I hope are accessible and are not sort of obscured by Asian cultural concepts and ideas. I think Zen and Tibetan Buddhism certainly complement one another. I don't see them as being in opposition. I think they both have great strengths, and I think in the West today, as we encounter all these diverse forms of Buddhism, I think it behoves us to look into them all and to see where we can find ideas and practices and teachings that address our condition, that speak to where we're at now in such a way that hopefully that can inspire us or in some way, make our lives that much more lucid and that much more rich.
Can I ask you why you stopped being a monk? Did you feel...
I stopped being a monk. It's a long and complicated story. Okay. Effectively, I got to the point where I felt that my monastic training had achieved what I had hoped it would. And I don't think I ever saw myself as a monk by vocation. Mm-hmm. I always felt that I was pursuing my monastic life because it was the optimal condition whereby I could devote myself wholeheartedly to Buddhist training. But once I completed that formal training, at least, I felt little need to remain in the monastic order. I also had met my wife shortly before I disrobed, or my wife-to-be as she was then, and we decided we would like to get married and return to the West. I was living in Korea then. We came back to England. But those sort of decisions are always quite complex, but that's more or less the outline of it.
Okay, good and evil.
Good and evil. Well, this, of course, is one of the big questions, and it would be presumptuous of me to say that in this short book of a couple of hundred pages, I finally nailed that down and have sorted it out. One thing, as you were talking, I was reflecting on how I don't think anybody, except perhaps a psychopath, would consider that they are doing evil. The people who flew the planes into the World Trade Center thought they were doing good. They were as convinced of that as perhaps you or I are convinced of times when we deliberately and consciously do something we regard to be good. Even Hitler thought he was doing good. He thought he was doing the world a favor. And so people whom we might regard as doing things that are extremely evil, from their point of view, they are seeking to realize the good. And I think the great charismatic power of someone like Osama bin Laden is that of all the things you can lay against him, all the terrible things that he's done, you can't really, at least as far as we can make out, accuse him of not being straightforward and or being hypocritical. I mean, he seems to believe very deeply and with complete conviction and honesty that his path in life is a good one. It's founded on his understanding, perhaps a distorted understanding, of the teachings of his faith, and he seeks to realize them. And so when we consider someone else evil, it's very often that they have a concept of the good which, if it were to be realized, would cause us to suffer. It would place limitations in our lives. It would deprive us of things that we value. For example, the freedoms we have in the Western world to speak freely and to choose our course in life, for women to have equal opportunity and so forth and so on, that we sense would almost certainly be damaged, if not destroyed, were the kind of world, according to Mr. Bin Laden and his friends, were to be imposed upon us. So we have to be aware of that, I think. There's a great danger, and you see this on both sides of the current political divide, to demonize the other, so that we've heard this language frequently, coming both from the White House, coming both from Al-Qaeda, that the people they are against, they are the evil people. Even words like Satan are used. The axis of evil, as comes from here in the United States. This kind of language I don't think is helpful. If anything, I think it actually makes matters worse. It tends to assume that all good, all that can conceivably be thought of good, resides in our way of life, in our kind of society, in our values. And anyone who's not with us on that is somehow thereby evil. And so that we project all of that negativity onto the other. In this case, it could be the whole Muslim world, or it could be whatever forces we feel are lined up against us. And in doing so, we then exacerbate that sense of conflict. It becomes increasingly difficult to really have any kind of considered, reasoned argument or debate or discussion. The whole thing is polarized. The whole thing is set off in an extreme of conflict. Now, of course, I have the advantage of being a writer, a theologian, a philosopher, as you wish, and so I'm not in a position, as some of our political leaders are, where I have to make hard, concrete decisions about the security of the country for which I'm charged. I'm not sure that I would do any better than the people whose actions I may not approve of now. It's an extraordinarily difficult situation in which we find ourselves, but I do think that we need to be very careful of effectively creating Satans and devils and gods in this environment, because it closes us down to being able to really understand where that other person might be coming from, what it is that motivates them to act in the way they do, what are the deep grievances and sufferings and pains that they're responding to. We just see it as bad, as evil, and something to be destroyed.
Yes, and when you mentioned creating gods, I don't need to want to be too polemic, but I really did feel that we were canonizing Ronald Reagan, and maybe that's a response to fears of evil somewhere else.
I'd not thought of that, but I was not in the United States during the week of the mourning of your former president, but what I picked up in Europe was actually very much that, and I suspect it's all part of the discourse that's going on in the media around the world, in trying to somehow trying to understand what it is that we regard as good. And But I think the danger is we become so terribly emotional about all of this, and we raise up icons and raise flags and get very worked up at the cost, I feel, of really understanding the complexity and the interconnectedness of this world in which we live, in which we can't be islands unto ourselves any longer, that we are all part of a world that we share. We all are living in a world with diminishing natural resources, particularly oil, that in no real way can be said to belong to any state or any particular economic power. I do think, and this is the thing that most appalled me about this whole recent affair, was the refusal to go along with the consensual decision-making process at the UN before possibly launching an attack. That breakdown of consensus, I think, is a terrible thing. Hopefully, that will be rebuilt. There are signs at the UN now, in some of your president's recent meetings with European leaders, that there is a move towards healing those rifts, and I think that's very important.
And if I can say one more thing, when you talked about people being too emotional, could you speak to the idea, we usually think of Greek philosophy as being, you know, the seat of reason, or,
yes.
You know, I'm wondering if you can talk about rationality in relation to Buddhism or meditation versus emotionalism.
Mm-hmm. Well, we see Buddhism is presented in the West, or I'll speak of the United States primarily. It's presented mainly as the path of meditation. The Buddhism almost invariably is followed by the word meditation. And meditation, for many of us, is a way to find a way of being in this world with greater awareness, with greater stillness, with greater focus, perhaps awakening a kind of intuition, a deeper sense of the nature of the world and ourselves, insight and so on. But this, although that I think is true, I think it actually misrepresents the richness of Buddhist tradition. I trained for 7 years in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery. Now, I did not in that time focus on meditation and mandalas and tantric deities and all this sort of thing. I studied logic, epistemology, psychology, philosophy in a highly rationalistic fashion, involving the study of debate and dialectics. And this was a tradition that was deeply rational, one that goes right back to the Buddha himself, but it probably became most influential in Buddhist tradition around about the 4th or 5th centuries AD. And those traditions still survive. Buddhism is very much committed to rationality. It, unlike some religions, it does not rest upon divine revelation, but it rests upon the insights of a man, Siddhartha Gautama, who gained an enlightenment, but not an enlightenment of some mystic unity of the world or anything like that, but an enlightenment about the nature of the human dilemma, its anguish and its suffering, and a way to somehow live in which we can resolve that dilemma. And I think more than anything else, Buddhism is a way of life.
Our guest for this part of Focus 580, Stephen Batchelor. He's a former, as we have explained here, and he has explained, he is a former monk, a Buddhist monk in both the Tibetan and Zen traditions. And he has written a lot about Buddhism. He's the author of a national bestseller, which is entitled Buddhism Without Beliefs. He now conducts lectures and meditation retreats around the world. He's a contributing editor for Tricycle, which is a Buddhist magazine. He makes his home in France, and he is now spending some time in the United States talking about this book that he has authored that's an exploration of the subject of good and evil, certainly basically from a Buddhist point of view. And the title of the book is Living with the Devil, A Meditation on Good and Evil, and it is published by Riverhead books. Questions are certainly welcome. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can, anywhere the signal will travel. If it would be a long-distance call for you, that's 800-222-9455. Or, again, if you're on the internet, you can use that number. So locally, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have another caller here, Bloomington, Indiana, so let's just go there next. Line number four. Hello.
Hi, hello. Mr. Batchelor. You said that the people who crashed the airplanes into the trade towers thought they were doing good. And when Hitler massacred 6 million Jews, he thought he was doing good. And you left the impression that indeed they might have been doing good, and we have no right to say that they were doing evil. And maybe it's even dangerous to conclude that they were doing evil. Is that the impression you meant to leave?
No, it's not. I certainly would not say of either of those people that they were doing good. I'm certainly saying they considered that they were doing good. And I would also not embrace a kind of relativism in which there really is no ground for good or evil. It's just what we think it is. If it's just a subjective judgment, then that would be, I think, an entirely inadequate basis for leading a moral life.
Then you do believe in moral absolutes.
I hesitate to use words like absolute. I realize that when I'm confronted with a difficult moral choice, then I have to fall back on my own reflections as to what it is that I value most deeply in this life. For example, I value freedom at all levels. To me, that's a very important value. I value kindness. I value non-harming, non-violence. These are irrational choices, perhaps. They come from what can only be my own upbringing. They also come from my involvement with my own faith tradition, that of Buddhism. And these, in a pragmatic sense, I suppose, are absolutes. I mean, these are values that I would not ever seek willingly to betray, and I would seek in my life always to embody them. But I recognize that they are my choices. They are the choices that inform my life, and I recognize that other people may have a completely different view of this world and different values and different concepts of what it means to be good. But I'm not willing to say, well, your choices and values are yours, mine are mine, Hitler's were Hitler's, and that's just their reality, that's fine. No, I think all of us are called upon as human beings to respond to the questions that life presents us with, to respond to the suffering that life is endlessly making manifest to us, and seeking in as best and as authentic and as a clear-headed way as possible a response to those questions in which we embody what we deep down are convinced is good. And that's always going to, that means that we'll always probably be in some state of opposition with those who choose to believe other than us. I believe in pluralism. I believe very much in allowing a society where people are given freedoms to choose and to live their lives as they best see fit. But, and here I would go back to the beginnings of the modern world, liberalism, John Stuart Mill and so on, as long as those freedoms do not inflict harm, or as long as the realization of those freedoms does not entail causing harm or pain to others, that is where I would draw the line. So people who feel that they are doing good and in doing so need to kill other people, that is not something I can accept.
You seem to be saying that good and evil must be subjective, and you don't seem to recognize any absolute moral authority outside yourself or outside the human, outside of humanity.
Well, as a Buddhist, I don't. And my tradition is one that does not posit an absolute authority, say, that of God, some unconditional absolute in which good and evil, or good primarily is rooted. And I do see good and evil as products of the human being. They are ways in which we make sense of the world to ourselves. And I find it very difficult. I'm not a theist. I can see the attraction of that belief. I can see how that would give one certainties that perhaps I will never quite reach. I feel that as human beings, we're all, in all of our individual and our social lives, struggling towards the realization of that which maximizes well-being and diminishes pain and suffering.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, we have about 10 minutes left, and we have some other callers, so we'll just get to next Charleston, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, hello. I heard you mention your association with dialectics a bit ago. And do you approach the dialectic through a mystical medium or a material?
The dialectic tradition in which I was educated in Tibetan monasteries was not a mystical one at all, but was actually a form of a debate. In other words, in Tibet, they developed a kind of formal language of argumentation as a kind of tool to subject their texts, the Buddha's teachings and so on, to a kind of rigorous critical analysis. And they invented what we would, equivalent perhaps of what we would say a formal logical or mathematical language, except this was spoken. But it was a language that was very precise, that enabled a discussion to follow the clear lines of syllogistic reasoning. In other words, being acutely aware at each step of the consequences of what you are saying in purely logical terms. And so after having studied a text with a teacher, then the students, the monks, would pair off and would formally debate one against the other, trying to find holes in the arguments of the text, trying to illuminate what the key concepts might mean, looking for contradiction, looking for ambiguity, trying to resolve that if possible. A highly rational training, one that one does not associate normally with, say, Tibetan Buddhism. One thinks immediately of mystics and Dalai Lamas and so on and so on. But this is a highly rational tradition. So not mystical at all, absolutely cut and thrust, Aristotelian-type reasoning.
Yes, sir, then if that would have been the case, why weren't the Buddhists then, with their rationale, the impetus would have been towards the material?
Why did Buddhists not move towards materialism, you mean?
It's because we live in a material world. This is a material existence.
Yes.
And all the spiritual dialogue and argumentation in the world is not going to bring us any closer to where we need to be unless we take a materialistic view. That is my opinion.
Uh-huh.
And if materialism is acknowledged as being the totality of existence, and all these spiritual things that have, like I heard you say a bit ago with Mr. Bush and his axis of evil, and what one perceives as evil and another perceives as good,
yes.
And that we have the Muslims now and all the other madness that's going on in this world.
Yes.
And then the material, I might add that my materialism is through the eyes of Marx,
mm-hmm.
And he was, I think, the exceptional, being the student of Hegel, who was a mystic.
Yes.
And he then progressed past the mystical or even the dialogue for dialogue's sake and would have had change on the agenda, which apparently all religions and all disorders of the world can be traced to those I'm right and you're wrong.
Right.
So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you, sir, very much.
Thank you. Well, I sympathize very much with that. My own involvement with Buddhism certainly started out as a spiritual quest. But as the time has gone on and as the years have passed, I've become less and less committed to a purely spiritual practice a purely spiritual life, and I think I would probably nowadays call myself a materialist. I don't believe, as most Buddhists do, in the existence of a disincarnate consciousness or mind that reincarnates from one body to the other. I find the current scientific explanation from evolutionary biology in particular infinitely more compelling as an account of how human life came to be than any kind of religious or mystical writings. And I've turned recently more and more in my work to trying to understand the human dilemma in terms of the drives that have generated this organism biologically, evolutionarily. And my work is very much about trying to articulate some of these Buddhist values in such a way that they enable us to honor the matter, the materiality that forms us, and seeking to live a life that certainly doesn't reduce everything just to dumb, inert matter, but at the same time does not pretend that spiritual salvation is reached by somehow denying or transcending the material world. I think we are material beings. This may be the only life we will ever have, and it is the product of, I believe, material causes and consequences. And so I feel that we're kind of on the cusp now of really needing another kind of spirituality. I feel that the Marxist sort of negation or denial of the value of any spiritual tradition goes too far, but I do feel that that critique is one that we cannot ignore, and we have to also likewise accept the emerging scientific worldview that presents an utterly compelling case for the essentially material nature of our existence.
You know, we're at the point where we pretty much have to stop, and I wish we could continue, because I'm interested, because Buddhism began in India, and as people took it out to China, to Tibet, to Japan, it changed. And
yes, absolutely.
So it practice changed because people who already had different sorts of ideas. They spun it in different sorts of ways, which I think is very interesting. That's why we have different Buddhist practice.
Exactly.
And I'm really interested in this notion of how it is that Buddhism has changed because it's been picked up by Westerners,
uh-huh.
and with their religious traditions already in their pockets, and their ideas about psychology and their ideas about science. And it sounds like as if in the last few things you were saying, that perhaps is an answer to that question.
Well, who knows? I think that one of the most exciting things that's happening is this encounter of Buddhist and other Asian traditions with not just the Western world, but with, I think, modernity itself. And all religions, I think, are challenged here. And as a Buddhist, you know, that's where I feel my work lies, to try to find a way of being true to the core values of the tradition, but clearing away a lot of the kind of superstitious and other dead matter that has accumulated around them in terms of pre-modern, pre-scientific worldviews and beliefs and so on. And in clearing that stuff away, we open up the field anew. We're in a fresh, unknown territory. And I think both individually and socially, human beings now somehow have to work towards a religious and spiritual sensibility that acknowledges and values this new situation in which we find ourselves. And that's an adventure.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure.
Our guest, Stephen Batchelor. And again, if you'd like to read more of his thoughts, you can look for his most recent book. It's titled Living with the Devil, A Meditation on Good and Evil, and it is published by Riverhead Books.